Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present John Quigley, Professor of International Law at Ohio State University, who assesses the significance of the recent UN General Assembly vote recognizing Palestine as a non-member observer state. Alex Lawson, Executive Director of the group Social Security Works, who discusses his group's campaign to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid from proposed cuts during fiscal cliff negotiations. And Sherry Fortland, a Louisiana mother of six, who talks about her journey to becoming an environmental justice activist engaged in civil disobedience to fight the fossil fuel industry and climate change. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The investigative website ProPublica reports Russia sent plane loads of cash to prop up the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad in an effort to undercut international sanctions. Since a civil society rebellion arose to oust Assad, the Syrian regime has waged a brutal crackdown, killing tens of thousands of civilians. ProPublica traced 8 cargo planes full of cash, which flew from Moscow to Damascus between July 9th and September 15th this year. According to a report by the International Monetary Fund, Syria has depleted its reserves of foreign currency since civil unrest began in March 2011. In the fall of 2011, the European Union imposed stiff sanctions on Syria, including a ban on the printing of Syrian currency. The Obama administration has also banned members of the Assad regime from traveling to the U.S. or operating within the U.S. financial system. With the loss of currency generated by foreign tourism and a ban on oil sales to boost its reserves, Syria faces increased economic stress. This comes as the value of Syrian currency has seen its value fall by 44% since 2011, and the anti-Assad insurgency is gaining momentum and is benefiting from new international support. Unlike the rest of Haiti, everything appears to work in the United Nations Logistics Center, the hub of relief workers, with new trailers, flowers planted along sidewalks, and cholera-free toilets. In this bubble of international influence, English is the official language, and few Haitians have access to United Nations and non-governmental organization decision-makers. Shortly after the massive earthquake that shook Haiti, which killed over 200,000 people, Logistical Base, or Log Base as the UN operations complex is known, has become the epicenter of Haiti's relief work. According to The Nation magazine, few Haitians were invited to help make key decisions. In what has become known as the NGO Republic of Haiti, a single international aid group has more cash and clout than the Haitian government. Meanwhile, 400,000 Haitians still live in tent cities, with Haitian politicians and civil society largely remaining powerless to influence aid projects. In 2010, international donors pledged $5.3 billion for Haiti's recovery, but less than half of the pledges have reached the island nation. Moreover, Haiti has had to confront a chronic cholera epidemic, which was unintentionally brought to the Caribbean country by UN peacekeepers. According to the Guardian newspaper, there were 340,000 cholera cases in Haiti last year. Sadly, Hurricane Sandy brought more devastation to Haiti in late October. Rivers quickly flooded, causing farmers to lose 80% of key crops, including corn, beans, bananas, and mangoes. As a result, the UN now says 1.5 million Haitians are at risk of going hungry. Mary Jennings Hegar won a Purple Heart and Distinguished Flying Cross in Afghanistan, where in 2009, her medevac helicopter full of injured soldiers was attacked near Kandahar. She was injured by shrapnel wounds in her forearm and thigh. Today, Hegar, along with 3 other female Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, are suing the Pentagon over the policy to exclude women from combat. The ban prevents women from serving in the infantry frontline units and hinders women from being eligible for certain promotions within the U.S. military. The American Civil Liberties Union, who represents the women plaintiffs, says the exclusion policy is discriminatory, preventing women from applying for 235,000 positions in the military. Women currently make up 14% of active duty military personnel and 20% of recruits. In Iraq and Afghanistan, women have engaged in combat while delivering supplies and providing medical aid. This is the second lawsuit filed by women veterans against the combat ban. The ACLU says it needs to demonstrate that the exclusion of women from combat roles is unconstitutional because it's not justified by a single government objective. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
One week after a ceasefire ended the recent cross-border violence between Israel and Hamas in Gaza on November 21st, the Palestinian Authority followed through on their long-standing plan to seek non-member observer state status in the United Nations General Assembly. The November 29th vote in favor of a new status for Palestine was overwhelming, with 138 in favor, 9 opposed, and 41 abstentions. Although the U.S. and Israel had strongly opposed the move, European nations such as France, Italy, Spain, Norway, Denmark, and Switzerland all voted yes, while Britain and Germany abstained. Among the benefits of Palestine's new status is their eligibility to join international bodies such as the International Criminal Court, where they could file charges against Israeli settlement building in the West Bank or the military assaults on the West Bank and Gaza. In response to the UN vote, Israel seized more than $120 million in tax revenue they collect for the Palestinian Authority. The Israeli government also announced plans to expand Jewish settlements in the West Bank by building 3,000 more housing units. More alarming was the order by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government to move ahead on plans to develop an area known as E1 east of Jerusalem that, if built, would effectively cut the West Bank in half. Britain, France, Spain, Sweden, and Denmark summoned the Israeli ambassadors to their countries to protest the settlement expansion. Your reporter spoke with John Quigley, professor of international and comparative law at Ohio State University. He assesses the significance of the recent UN General Assembly vote upgrading Palestine's status and the prospects for restarting long-stalled peace negotiations.
On one side, you have the statement that was made by the United States ambassador following the vote on Thursday, in the General Assembly, where she said that the resolution does not mean that Palestine is actually a state. So you have that point of view, which I think would be shared by Israel and maybe two other states in the world, that the resolution does not actually regard Palestine as a state. That is, of course, completely in contradiction to the text of it that refers to Palestine as a state. However, for the government of Palestine, it involves a continuing, you might say, higher level of acceptance of it as a state, which is going to make it easier for Palestine to participate in international organizations in a variety of ways that will assist the people of Palestine. There are quite a few treaties that could be entered into by Palestine that might enhance its position in a rather practical way. One is the Law of the Sea Convention that deals with such things as control over ocean space for fishing, which, of course, has been an important bone of contention off the Gaza coast, and as well to undersea minerals, which could potentially be important in preserving Palestine's rights to the natural gas deposits that are off the shore of Gaza. There's also an international treaty on civil air transport that acknowledges a state's control over airspace and has procedures to protect that, and that, of course, is an issue because of the flights by Israeli aircraft over Palestine territory, including the drones like the ones that were over Gaza during the recent attack there. But more generally, I think Palestine can operate more effectively at the international level, being considered a state. The next step, of course, would be to membership in the UN, which would enhance its position even farther.
Professor Quigley, the Israelis promised retaliation, and they did, after this vote, withhold $120 million in tax revenue from the Palestinian Authority, but maybe more importantly, they vowed to build 3,000 more housing units in contested areas of both East Jerusalem and the West Bank. And there's also plans afoot to develop land in a very controversial spot that would divide the West Bank in half. What can you tell us about the price that the Palestinians will be paying given this threat of Israeli retaliation here?
Well, it's unclear exactly how that threat will be carried out. Israel has come in for some very severe criticism in the last 24 hours over this. The European governments, interestingly, are getting into the act and calling in Israeli ambassadors in their capitals and making it clear that Europe is not prepared to put up with this. And Europe has quite a bit of leverage because of the trade relations between Israel and Europe, leverage that potentially could be used by Europe. But the threat to initiate this major new settlement development east of Jerusalem, you know, is potentially a very serious matter, and it would, in effect, make it impossible to get from the southern part of the West Bank to the northern part of the West Bank for Palestinians. I mean, it's already very difficult, but this would make it much more difficult. But it highlights, again, the importance of what Palestine may be able to do as a state, because once the International Criminal Court prosecutor decides that the court has jurisdiction over crimes committed in Palestine, one of the crimes that it could investigate would be the establishment of settlement.
Well, just a final question for you, Professor Quigley. It's widely believed across the world that Israel won't bend in any future negotiations with the Palestinians off the hard line it's taken of recent years without United States pressure. And now that the U.S. election has passed, do you think the Obama administration has any possibility of applying pressure to Israel to be a fair broker for future peace negotiations that could succeed after so many decades of failure?
Well, that's a $64,000 question, I suppose. The history on this has not been good. U.S. administrations haven't been inclined to divert. Both political parties think they have to be very solicitous of Israel in order to retain power in the United States, so that even in a second term, the Obama administration is going to be concerned about the next election and whatever Democrat runs. And there are, of course, elections for Congress again in 2 years. So that's the negative side. The positive side is that you did have President Obama at the beginning of his first term seemingly opening up to the Arab world with his speech in Cairo in 2009. And for a time, that raised the popularity of the United States quite dramatically in the region. So he has some sort of precedent, you might say, for having taken action that moves in the opposite direction.
That was John Quigley, professor of international and comparative law at Ohio State University. He is the author of The Statehood of Palestine. For more analysis and commentary on the drive for Palestinian statehood, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. With the so-called fiscal cliff looming at the end of the year, President Obama and Congress have begun talks that could result in an agreement to avert the congressionally mandated $500 billion in tax increases and $109 billion in domestic and Pentagon spending cuts that are scheduled to kick in on January 1st. President Obama opened with a proposal that echoed his campaign theme of demanding that the Bush-era tax cuts for the nation's wealthiest 2% be allowed to expire, while retaining reduced tax rates for those making under $250,000. Obama's plan would raise taxes by $1.6 trillion while cutting $350 billion from the Medicare and Medicaid programs over the next decade by lowering drug costs and reimbursements to health care providers. In their counteroffer, the House Republicans proposed increasing taxes by $800 billion over 10 years through an overhaul of the tax code that would eliminate unspecified tax breaks while lowering tax rates overall. The GOP plan would leave the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest in place. Over the next 10 years, the Republicans would cut $600 billion from health care programs by increasing the eligibility age for Medicare and raising Medicare premiums for higher-income beneficiaries. The GOP also proposes lowering cost-of-living increases for Social Security recipients. While the president promptly rejected the Republican Party proposal, progressive groups were leery of an eventual deal that could see major cuts to social safety net programs, some of which were specifically embraced by Mr. Obama during his talks with the GOP House Speaker John Boehner in the summer of 2011. Your reporter spoke with Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works, part of the Strengthened Social Security Coalition, made up of 300 national and state organizations. Here, Lawson talks about the fiscal cliff negotiations and his group's efforts to protect Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid from proposed cuts in what is often referred to as the grand bargain.
What we saw from the president was something that we've been asking for over 2 years. We've been asking for the administration to stand strongly for these American programs, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And in the offer he did, they've been saying Social Security is off the table. Social Security by law cannot borrow a penny, so it cannot contribute to the deficit. Therefore, it has no place in any deficit discussion. When it comes to Medicare, in the president's proposal, what you saw was some very large numbers, and they're scary, because $400 billion in savings is a lot of money that they're talking about over 10 years. At the same time, Center for American Progress put out a report that detailed $385 billion in savings and efficiencies that did not directly cut benefits. And I think that's an important distinction. So fundamentally, the president's offer did stay with what you're seeing as a united progressive position that says no benefit cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and no tax cuts for the richest 2%. On the other side, what you saw from the Republican counterproposal, it was just saying we're not going to enter these negotiations because it was not at all a real proposal. The revenue side of it was based on dynamic scoring, which basically means it's fake revenue, it included devastating cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and it didn't really spell out any of the specifics. It was not a serious attempt at negotiating.
Last year, President Obama reportedly was willing to deal away a lot of cuts in Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid as well when he met with Speaker of the House John Boehner. And there are a lot of organizations out there very concerned about what might happen in the endgame of these negotiations that could very well see the White House meet the Republicans halfway, which might include some of these big benefit cuts and raising the retirement age of Medicare. What's your feeling about where these negotiations may go, given the history of President Obama's previous positions in what was called back then the so-called grand bargain?
Look, Social Security Works and the progressive movement writ large are united on a very simple line in the sand. It says no benefit cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and no tax cuts for the richest 2%. Any deal that crosses that line is unacceptable. The AFL-CIO, the SEIU, Move On, it's a host. It's probably the largest collection of progressive organizations I've ever seen on a unified point. Now, where is the negotiation going to go by those on the inside? You know, I think we are worried because we have seen that the administration has, in previous negotiations, put forward cuts that are anathema to progressive values. But the one thing that we know we can control, and the one thing that your listeners know they can control, is we can make sure we are clear about where our line in the sand is. We can make sure that our legislators are hearing from us, that our member and our two senators are all hearing from us for the next 3 weeks, very clearly stating our line in the sand. This is the line, and anything that crosses, no benefit cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and no tax cuts for the richest 2%, is unacceptable to us.
Alex, you talked about the large coalition that's come under the banner of no cuts to the nation's social safety net programs, but what kind of pressure can be exerted by this coalition of progressive groups to ensure that the White House, President Obama, doesn't cross that line in the sand? What can you do?
Well, I think that I believe in really simple plans. So at this moment, what we have to do is make a din in the clamor. We have to make sure that we are making as much noise as possible, both in D.C., which includes meeting with members, their staff, bringing constituents into the city and walking them around the Hill. That's happening right now. The AFL and a collection of labor organizations did that last week. The 5th, there will be a call-in day, a national call-in day, that is also taking place at the same time as some actions in front of Social Security offices all around the country. These are the type of things, it really does work when you can create this pressure. I mean, we all know that the lame duck session, people are basically looking at the clock, waiting for the time they can get on the plane and go home for the holidays. And if we can just make sure that everybody knows that the entire country is watching what they're doing, and we are not going to accept benefit cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. We're not going to accept tax cuts for the richest 2%. I think that D.C. is going to listen, and I think that most probably they'll somewhat kick the can down the road. They're not going to want to fly right in the face of this intense popular backlash or this organizing that's happening all around the country.
That was Alex Lawson, executive director of the group Social Security Works. For more information on groups working to protect the nation's social safety net and analysis of the fiscal cliff negotiations, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In mid-November, more than 100 activists gathered at an historically black church in Boston's South End for the New England 350.org Convergence to share stories about organizing successes and to discuss the next steps in fighting climate change after the U.S. election. Sherry Feutlin, who lives in South Central Louisiana, was one of the speakers at a morning roundtable. She's a small-town journalist, blogger, and mother of six children. Her husband works on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. After the BP Gulf oil disaster in the spring of 2011, Feutlin walked more than 1,200 miles from New Orleans to Washington, D.C. to demand government action to stop the massive BP Gulf oil spill. In October, as part of the tar sands blockade protest campaign, Feutlin chained herself to a gate of a Texas pipe yard, part of TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline project, and was charged with criminal trespass. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus, who was at the 350.org Boston gathering and heard Feutlin speak about her activism, later caught up with her by phone at her home in Rain, Louisiana. Here, Feutlin describes her journey to becoming an environmental justice activist and her arrests in several states protesting fossil fuel extraction and climate change, both of which disproportionately impact communities like hers near the Gulf of Mexico.
I'm a journalist for a small-town paper, and I went out on a tour that was guided by BP, but I felt like I didn't get the real story, so I went back the next week and jumped on a boat with a fishing family and was really moved by what I saw as real consequences, tangible consequences, devastating consequences to the communities along the Gulf Coast, who I love, and the area that I love, and the ecosystem that I adore. And I really had to take a hard look at myself and realize what I was contributing to that. And I don't just mean that my husband, you know, working in the oil industry, it's a strange paradigm here, but we really have very few choices. You know, we've become so dependent on the industry itself. So part of my work has been to try to bring in green energy options here and try to change the social currency that's here that keeps us so reliant on an industry that is so determined to basically kill us. They don't care about us. They don't care about our oil workers. They don't care about our families. They don't care about our ecosystems.
Sherry Feutlin, when you spoke in Boston in mid-November, two other workers had just been killed on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico. How common an occurrence is that?
You are not going to get a study anywhere out of the oil industry itself. It's responsible for reporting its releases, and it's also responsible for reporting any injuries. Very often, the oil workers themselves are punished in the way that you do have stop work authority, but you can be blackballed for using that authority. We have no unions here. There's no protection here for the oil worker. There's very few protections for the whistleblower. So that's pretty much what happened on the Deepwater Horizon, in that some of the men, even the men that were killed, had said that day even to their loved ones back home that they thought that they were going to die on that rig. They knew something was wrong. They tried to get help. They called into Houston and were denied a voice, let alone protection of their body, because honestly, for the oil companies, it's cheaper to pay for a funeral than it is to set up engineering and safety restrictions that would protect these workers out here on the rigs and on land. That's part of the dilemma that we face.
You mentioned trying to bring green alternatives to your community. What does that look like in your town?
In Lafayette, Louisiana, the Sierra Club and myself and others are working really hard. We actually have two coal power plants here. We're trying very hard by 2014 to get us off of those coal power plants and to bring in energy alternatives. But also an important aspect of that is I would really like to see a co-op kind of agreement so that we can provide the educational and health opportunities that we need here and work industry opportunities here, and also community agreements so that the oil workers are able to divest themselves from the fossil fuel industry and go work with something that's going to provide a sustainable future for our children.
I know you've been arrested several times protesting various fossil fuel projects, you know, basically around the country. How did you, as the mother of six and the wife of an oil worker, come to that decision to be arrested?
I was trying to look for anything that would work, and I read a lot about the civil rights movement of the 1960s. I read the letters from Dr. King when he was sitting in the Birmingham jail, and he said that when negotiations fail and there's nothing left, that the only thing we have to turn to is nonviolent direct action. So last year, I was arrested in front of the BP office trying to return the tar balls to them that continue to litter our beach and probably will for the next 30 years, and was arrested at that time for refusing to leave. Not too long after that, I was up in D.C. for the protesting the Keystone XL pipeline, thanks to 350.org and the climate justice movement, which also has had devastating effects on our communities. We have had six major hurricanes in the last 7 years and are still dealing with Katrina, Rita, Isaac to this day. And unfortunately, the southern leg of that pipeline is coming down through Oklahoma and Texas and threatening our Houston environmental justice communities, as well as Port Arthur, which is one of our most devastated environmental justice communities in the Gulf of Mexico. And so I was arrested there. I think it's been about 2 months ago. But honestly, it's not about the arrest as it is the fact that people in the Gulf of Mexico have no voice, and this is what we are left to do. And if myself, being a mother of six, have to take one for the home team and get arrested now and lose my freedom for as long as they decide to keep me in order to protect my children so that they have clean air and water and a livelihood that doesn't take their life away, then I'll gladly give myself up. I think any mother would.
That was environmental justice activist Sherry Foytlin, author of Spill It, The Truth About the Deepwater Oil Rig Explosion. Find links to Foytlin's articles and more information on climate change activism on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.